With history in the background, presidents take the foreground.
I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
As the Holy Quran tells us, be conscious of God and speak always the truth.
Does the comparison work? President Barack Obama is not the first American president to speak to the Muslim world. He is the first to do it in the land of the pharaohs. Is it a photo op in Cairo or a turning point in the Middle East? Obama takes it to the River Nile on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, June 4th, and just after 3 in the afternoon in Cairo, I'm John Hockenberry here with Andrea Bernstein. We've been taking a look at that speech from Cairo. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, global reaction to President Obama's big speech from a variety of perspectives. Plus, we'll go to California, where massive budget cuts mean a lot of people are going to feel the pain. All this and more ahead. But first, this morning's top headlines.
And in the headlines, President Obama wrapped up within the hour his speech, which began with a greeting to the Muslim world.
I'm also proud to carry with me the goodwill of the American people and a greeting of peace from Muslim communities in my country. Assalamu alaikum.
The wide-ranging speech called for a new beginning between American and the Muslim worlds. He stressed ongoing American support for an independent Palestinian state and said Palestinians must do their part.
Palestinians must abandon violence. Resistance through violence and killing is wrong, and it does not succeed.
The president urged the Muslim world to reject terrorism and end threats to Israel. He pledged to personally work to break the stalemate between Israelis and Palestinians. He called for an ending of settlements in the occupied territories and said the U.S. had no territorial ambitions in either Afghanistan or Iraq. Much more on the speech coming up. Andrea?
Beijing's Tiananmen Square is under strict police protection now. China's government doesn't want protests marking the deadly military crackdown on pro-democracy activists 20 years ago. The final death toll will never be known, but it could be in the thousands. The government is also censoring foreign news networks and websites inside the country. Staying in Asia, two American journalists are apparently starting to move through North Korea's court system, that according to the Russian news agency TASS. They're charged with illegal entry. They've been in jail since the government picked them up in March. The charges could carry a sentence of up to 10 years in a forced labor camp. Some analysts believe the government wants to use the women as bargaining chips in nuclear negotiations.
Accident investigators now believe the Air France flight broke apart before crashing into the Atlantic Ocean. The Rio to Paris flight sent a series of automatic messages that seemed to signal this, but there's no indication of what caused the crash, which killed 228 people. Same-sex couples in New Hampshire could start planning their weddings. The governor's signature on a new bill means gay marriages can take place as early as January. The Dow dropped nearly 1% yesterday. It starts trading at 86.75. We've been talking about President Obama's speech in Cairo today. We're going to have reaction from all sorts of perspectives throughout this hour. We'd love to include your reaction at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good speech? Did it connect with you? Or are we just completely overplaying it? Is it an Ich bin ein Berliner moment or just a photo op? You decide. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. It's Andrea Bernstein here with John Hockenberry. We're talking about President Barack Obama's just-concluded speech in Cairo, Egypt. Here's an excerpt.
At the same time, Israelis must acknowledge that just as Israel's right to exist cannot be denied, neither can Palestine's. The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements.
It's one of the headlines from the speech, arguably. There were a number
That's
of
right.
them in the speech, which took about an hour to be delivered from Cairo University earlier this morning.
The president also said it's wrong to blow up women and children on buses. He also said the cycle of suspicion and discord between the United States and the Muslim world must end. Joining us in studio to discuss the speech is Marcus Mabry, the New York Times international business editor. Excuse me, Mabry, I knew that. And Muna Shikaki, correspondent for Al Arabiya in Washington, D.C. She joins us now. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Muna. How do you think the Arab world, if you can even sort of think of it that way, heard this speech and break it down for us, if you want, among different communities?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There's not one monolithic view in the Arab world of America or of President Obama. But in general, what struck me most about this speech was the fact that it was obvious that Obama understands that the debates that are happening within the Arab world itself. And I thought that was really nuanced. He knew exactly the arguments that were used, the justifications for violence. And he also acknowledged things that a lot of other people have not talked about before, like the history of colonialism. He understands why the Arabs and the Muslims have a problem with the United States. During the Bush administration, there was a lot of talk about the fact that the Arab world misunderstands the United States. And I think we're past that now. Obama understands that there are actual reasons. He might disagree with them. The United States might disagree with these reasons, but they are legitimate reasons. And he's talking about them. He was talking about, you know, how the United States has dealt with Iran, how they had overthrown the government there. And I think that brings a lot of clarity to the relationship between the Muslim world, the Arab world, if you can look at it, like you said, as such, and the United States.
As a matter of fact, in one of the few places where he ad-libbed in the speech, which went on for almost an hour, he made reference to the debate as evidenced by the big applause lines for what he had to say about the rights of women. Let's listen to a clip.
Freedom in America is indivisible from the freedom to practice one's religion. That is why there is a mosque in every state in our union and over 1,200 mosques within our borders. That's why the United States government has gone to court to protect the right of women and girls to wear the hijab and to punish those who would deny it.
The woman's pronouncer there.
Right. But Marcus, maybe from the New York Times international business editor, how do you think people, you know, the fact that the sort of women's rights issues was one of the big applause lines, and there were plenty of things that were met with silence while he mm-hmm. was there. Well, how do you think, what do you think that says about sort of where the Arab world is in its debate now?
Well, it's really interesting. That's a great question. I mean, I thought the speech was so powerful because you really saw the power of the personal history of this president. He really brought to bear, as he said, you know, I've witnessed Islam on three continents.
Marcus, hold on for just a second. We're joined now unexpectedly by Amir Moussa, who's the former general secretary of the Arab League, or former Egyptian foreign minister and secretary general of the Arab League, to give us some instant reaction to the Barack Obama speech. Foreign Minister Amir Moussa, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
How do you think, well, first of all, how did you react to the speech? It was an addressing of all kinds of issues. It was very wide-ranging, but what was the biggest theme that stood out for you?
I must tell you that my immediate reaction is very favorable. The president has said was all, in fact, a call for a balanced approach and a vision for the future built on peace, on cooperation, and mentioned the prerequisites for such a move or such a progress towards peace and stability in the region. The two-state solution, the abandonment of violence and extremism, the freeze on settlements, on building settlements and moving to eliminate them, the nuclear-free world, meaning nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, that all countries should abide by that, the economic and social development, the freedom of religion. Now, all that, in fact, are points that we agree with.
Well, Amir Moussa, let me nuance that a little bit. It seems on many levels this was a restatement of longstanding U.S. policy, particularly on settlements and a two-state solution. You may be able to quibble that he pushed things forward on the nuclear realm. How do you construe an essentially restatement of U.S. policy as something that moves things forwards, particularly from your perspective?
Well, I believe that the regional security, which we all need to guarantee, is not the security of one country or two countries or sub-region. The whole situation, security situation in the region requires that this region, the Middle East, becomes a zone free from nuclear weapons. And this goes hand in hand with the general call of the president in his speech of 5 April in Prague, that he wants to see a zero option on the nuclear armament or weapons in the world.
Well,
so I think that this is important.
Well, I mean, Musa, go ahead.
I have a word commenting on what you said, that those are all long-standing American commitments. Now, it's not a question of commitment. It's a question of implementation, a policy, a new policy. And we have seen this commitment anyway wavering in the last few years.
Well,
this is a reaffirmation, reawakening of this commitment, American commitment.
Two great headlines there. What of this commitment becomes an actual deliverable? And it sounds like the other headline you're extracting, and I think it's really interesting, is that the non-proliferation discussion of nukes also refers to Israel in this speech. Amir Moussa, Secretary General of the Arab League, former Egyptian foreign minister, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Also joining us in studio is Marcus Mabry, the New York Times international business editor. What do you think of the first thing out of the box from Amir Moussa? I responded to this very favorably.
I thought it was impressive. You know, the fact that he even challenged John. John challenged him. He came back and said, no, what's new about this is this reaffirmation. The fact that Arab leaders are willing to take this as a new march, a new stage in the U.S.'s pushing diplomatically for a two-state solution, then that already is progress. And I'm impressed by it because I don't see what's particularly new about it. I do not expect us to pursue a nuclear-free Israel. That's not going to happen.
One of the things that he said at the outset of his speech was he commented on his own name.
Now much has been made of the fact that an African-American with the name Barack Hussein Obama could be elected president.
That is not something that we've heard him say a lot, even talk about his name, and yet he sort of did that as an opener, an icebreaker in this speech.
Well, again, you really saw, I think, the power of the personal here. He was about history. He was about politics. He was about talking about all the people of the book, as they're called, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. But I really was impressed by how he said, I have known Islam on three continents before I came here. My father, my grandfather were Muslim. I was very impressed by the admissions of that. Obviously, it doesn't happen here in the political campaign in the U.S., and we didn't expect it. But polls have shown us over and over again that Americans did have an expectation that this president, because of his personal history and because of who he is, would have an ability to change the image of the United States in the world. And I think we saw the beginnings of that in this kind of rapturous applause he got many times in the speech.
Well, Muna Shikaki, before we end this segment, correspondent for Al Arabiya, is Amir Moussa's reaction to the speech, does that begin to constitute something of a news story from your perspective? Do you think his reaction is significant in any way?
Well, I think the popularity of Obama in the Arab world is a lot. The same way that the popularity of Obama here in the United States is higher than the popularity of Democrats, the popularity of Obama in the Arab world is much higher than the popularity of the United States in the Arab world. That's not saying much. But it gives a window for people in the Arab world to react to the speech. And when you talk to Arab Americans here and when you talk to people in the Arab world, there's a lot of hope, like Amir Moussa said, that this would actually turn into implementation. But a lot of people are still wondering what exactly is going to happen. All-American administration have talked about settlements. Is he actually going to go far enough to solve this issue? Or is it just going to be, you know, the same old talk? And if you also look at opinion polls, latest Gallup poll in the Arab world, you see that there's a doubling of the percentage of people who are withholding judgment of the United States. And I think this speech is definitely one step in the right direction.
We need to just wrap up this segment, but he got a big applause for what he had to say about Guantanamo and withdrawal from Iraq. Thanks very much, Muna Shikaki, correspondent for Al Arabiya. She's in Washington, D.C. Marcus Mabry, New York Times international business editor. We will continue this conversation on President Obama's speech that he just finished delivering this morning in Cairo,
Egypt. It's a fascinating fact from Muna Shikaki that a doubling of the number of people in the Arab world who are withholding judgment on the United States, and this speech extends that. That's interesting. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. And Andrea Bernstein, Barack Obama's speech from Cairo had headlines, it seems to me, on the nuclear issue, the Arab-Israeli conflict,
women,
Iraq, Afghanistan. And there was this headline, I think it's fair to say.
In the middle of the Cold War, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government. Since the Islamic Revolution, Iran has played a role in acts of hostage-taking and violence against U.S. troops and civilians. This history is well-known.
Barack Obama speaking from Cairo University earlier today, talking about the nation of Iran. Joining us now is John Line, BBC correspondent based in Tehran, where there was reaction to Barack Obama's speech even before he gave it. Good morning, John.
Yeah, good morning.
How do you, first of all, what do you make of the reaction from the supreme leader of Iran who spoke before Barack Obama spoke today, and what actually was explicitly said about Iran in the speech?
Yeah, it's interesting. Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, felt the need to issue, I think, what you guys called a pre-buttle. He came out and spoke very strongly early this morning before the speech, saying that the policies of the United States has caused great anger and harm to the people of the region. And he said beautiful words to the Muslim world would not be enough. Iran wanted to see action. I think lots of telling things here. First of all, I think there's some justice in saying that for all Mr. Obama has said so far, he hasn't actually indicated very concretely different policies towards Iran. There's still no actual change in policy on the nuclear issue, for example, that we've heard. That said, I don't see that Iran is interested in a reconciliation. There's been no indication from this government they are interested in a real warming of relations with the United States. But I think the most telling thing really about that effort to preempt the speech by the Iranian authorities is that clearly they know what their people think. And they know that many, many Iranians are indeed fascinated by President Obama, are intrigued by what he's saying, and are very interested in a reconciliation. Sometimes I go out and do interviews about this issue in the streets, and for the sake of balance, I'm always looking for somebody to criticize President Obama. And I can tell you they're quite hard to find these days.
John Line, one of the things that I noticed about the speech is, for most of it, President Obama was very careful to say, on the one hand, on the other hand, Palestinians think this, Israelis think this, but I understand this and this is wrong. With the Iranians, he really only talked about the nuclear issue, although he did acknowledge that the U.S. had a role in overthrowing a democratically elected government in Iran. He had not too much to say to the Iranian people. What do you think they will hear in this speech, assuming that they can get access to it?
I think they'll get access because they'll hear it on the BBC, see it on the BBC, on the Voice of America and so forth. Many people here, certainly wealthy and more educated people here, have access to these sort of sources of information. I think, obviously, that a lot of the message to the Muslim world in general will be applicable to people here. And there definitely is a feeling of hurt here, as there is in many parts of the Muslim world, that they feel they've been badly treated, rightly or wrongly, by the United States. So I think they will be interested by that message. The only problem is the other half of this equation doesn't really work here, because a big part of President Obama's message is saying that he will do his best to pursue peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And the trouble is, that's not what the government here wants. They are not interested in a two-state solution. They're interested in, as has been said, wiping Israel off the map. So that bit is not a very attractive. In fact, it's a disincentive, because this government is not interested at all in this kind of Israeli-Palestinian deal that Mr. Obama is pursuing.
Well, the Iranian government, as you've noted a couple of times on our program, John Line, is in the middle of a political campaign right now. And I'm wondering if you think that this line from Barack Obama's speech, explicitly about Iran, works as a bit of a tagline for the political campaign. Listen.
The question now is not what Iran is against, but rather what future it wants to build.
Does that resonate, and could that be a candidate speaking in Iran?
You know, it's very interesting. Clearly, the White House has thought this through very hard, and he's making this speech just before not just the Iranian elections, but also the Lebanese elections. I have to say, it kind of indicates to me a touching American faith in the strength of democracy in these countries. Whether or not people here do have a choice, I think they do have a choice, because I think Iranian people, any candidate except Ahmadinejad, is in favor of better ties with the United States, or at least less fiery rhetoric. And I think, yes, this could well play into the Iranian election campaign. And I think a lot of people are very, very interested in voting for a candidate who is not Mr. Ahmadinejad.
John, I noticed that the audience in Cairo gave no applause to President Obama's line about basically disarming Iran, that there was just silence in the room. Why do you think that is?
Because I don't think that's a huge issue in the Middle East, firstly, in the rest of the Middle East, but also because Iran plays very complicatedly into Middle Eastern issues. On the one hand, there's a kind of solidarity with the Iranian people. On the other hand, there's the Shiite-Sunni divide, the Arab-Persian divide. So the Arab world doesn't engage very much with Iranian issues until the day they really see Iran as a direct threat.
No, it's interesting, John Lyon. The one reference to the Sunni-Shia divide was all about Iraq. It actually didn't refer to Iran at all. John Lyon, BBC correspondent, our partners, the BBC. John Lyon, of course, based in Tehran. Thanks for being with us. Marcus Mabry, New York Times international business editor, is here. What do you make of the Iranian notion that we're not wavering on Israel, but there is actually a great deal of interest on the streets there, according to John Lyon, of making closer ties with the United States?
Well, this has been the great challenge, not just for this administration, but for the previous administration, too, in the U.S. There is a divide in Iran between the people and the government, and there's different feelings there. There's a divided leadership between what the Ayatollah wants to do, who's really in charge, and what elected leadership wants to do. This is the division that we're going to see play out in this election. I love that when you talk about the silence, there was also silence about that line when Obama said that we must also bridge the gap between Muslims, between Sunnis and Shiites. It was as if the audience was sitting on its hands. And I thought, wow, this is a moderate, educated Egyptian audience. If they feel that way, as they did about Israel's right to exist, also stunned, absolute silence.
And that we don't know if it was a hand-picked audience by the Mubarak leadership there in Egypt. So but a very interesting point you raised, Marcus Mabry. We're going to come back with more analysis and also a look at the NBA Finals. That's also big news today. But Femi Okeh has all the rest of the headlines. Thanks, Fem.
You're very welcome. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Now, President Obama had his speech this morning at Cairo University in Egypt. And before he even spoke, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, had some tough words for the United States. That was ahead of his speech. Now, Khamenei said that the U.S. is deeply hated in the Middle East and that a few beautiful words from President Obama won't make a difference unless policy changes along with it. Today, Iran is observing the 20th anniversary of the death of its state founder. In Pakistan, President Obama's special envoy to the region, Richard Holbrooke, visited two refugee camps where 3 million people are displaced from fighting in the Swat Valley. He pledged another $200 million in aid from Washington. Pakistan's government's offensive against Taliban militants in the area has Washington's approval. And finally, Chicago is in mourning today for the singer known as the Queen of the Blues. That's Coco Taylor singing her 1965 hit, Wang Dang Doodle. Coco died age 80 yesterday.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Andrea Bernstein with John Hockenberry. We have Marcus Mabry here. We have Muna Shikaki from Al Arabiya. But joining us now from Beirut is Rami Khoury, the editor-at-large of the Daily Star. Good morning, or I guess it's afternoon there.
Yes, good afternoon.
What is the view of the speech there from Lebanon?
Well, there's different views among different people, but I think the general sentiment is probably going to be, and certainly mine is, that the tone and the approach of Obama was generally quite positive, slightly pedantic and a bit of preaching, but generally positive. I think the body language, coming to Cairo, making the effort to take this initiative, all of these are positive elements I think will be well appreciated. The most important thing I thought was his putting the Israelis and the Palestinians at the same level, basically saying that both of them had equal rights, both had to make concessions, both had obligations under the roadmap, and both had rights to statehood and security. That was pretty strong, and I think that was a little nudge forward, not new American policy for him, but for him to emphasize it like that was important. He kind of started talking to Hamas a little bit in a funny American presidential way, so that was kind of interesting. Most of the rhetoric about Islam was nice rhetoric, but really no substance, nothing new in it. And there is a slight negative aspect, possibly, that is he's still obsessed, as Americans are, with 9/11 and Osama bin Laden, and they've really got to overcome this hurdle. He just said that 9/11 was a trauma, which it was. It was a crime. It was a trauma. It was a tragedy. And the Americans have to overcome this and address the issues that are the ones that define American mutual interest with the people of the Arab-Asian region. He shouldn't talk about the Islamic.
But Rami Khoury, I noticed that when President Obama said 9/11 was a fact, not an opinion, that was another one of the places where there was dead silence. And, you know, clearly he's not only speaking to a world audience, he's speaking to an American audience, who the kind of people who are listening to the Dick Cheneys of the world, who don't want to think that the president is standing down on terrorism. Does that come as a surprise to you there in Beirut?
No, not really. I mean, there's no doubt about the American position on terrorism. And I think the vast, overwhelming majority of people in the world, Muslims and everybody else, agrees with the U.S. that terrorism is a terrible thing. So there's no doubt about having a legitimate war against terrorists. And people have been doing that in this region much longer than the Americans have been doing, because we've suffered from terrorism much longer. So I think there's a psychological problem in the U.S. in political psychology, you know, how to overcome the trauma of 9/11 and address the political issues and the issues of people's rights that have to be addressed to get the kind of security and stability that we all want. I think he made a step in that direction when he talked about the U.S. is supporting human rights everywhere, will support all democratically elected governments that serve their people. There's a lot of really nice touches in the speech. I think overall positive, but nothing new. That's the problem.
Let me bring in Muna Shikaki. She's the correspondent for Al Arabiya. In Washington, D.C. Mona, what do you think about that point? Was it wrong for President Obama to bring up 9/11?
Well, I think it's interesting because, like Rami said, this is a speech for more than one audience. And to me, it was good for him to say that, because I think a lot of people in the Arab world, like Rami said, don't understand that. And I think it's part of the beginning of the dialogue is people in the Arab world to understand the impact that 9/11 had, which is not the same impact that they have in the Arab world. It's a watershed moment for the United States, but it really was not that much of a watershed moment for the people in the Arab world, and part of dialogue is understanding this. I was actually looking at our website right now, Al Arabiya's website, and looking at reactions. We've had hundreds of reactions on the speech. It's the front story on our website, and you see a lot of really interesting feedback. You have some of the positive feedback saying, I like the way he framed the issues. I wish people in the Arab world would address these same issues and arguments and justifications that Obama was addressing himself. But most of the reaction was, we like what he say, we want what he says, but we want action. We like the way he frames the debate, but we've heard the positions themselves before. We're waiting to see what will happen next.
Well, Mona, what do you think of what Rami said, that the sort of Muslim references in a place like Lebanon, known for a certain amount of secularism, might, you know, be glossed over by a lot of people in the Arab world, and that they're much more concerned about the issues of democracy that perhaps they would wish that their own leaders would address?
I think he's absolutely right in the point that the Arab world is not monolithic and the Muslim world is not monolithic, and that each country has different issues that it cares about. But in general, and in opinion polls that go repetitively around the Arab world, there is the issue of Iraq, withdrawal from Iraq, and the issue of Guantanamo, and the issue of, the Israeli-Arab conflict keeps on coming up as being an important issue. So yes, there are nuances, there are differences between countries, especially when you talk about Lebanon. But in general, I mean, we can't go around the fact that these are issues that are important to everyone.
Is it new to get people saying, I liked the tone of the speech, now let's see action? I mean, do you think that signals any kind of shift in public opinion?
Well, I don't know if it does or not, but, you know, we've been covering this, you know, in preparation for the speech. I've been covering some stories from here, from the United States, talking to Arab Muslims and Arab Americans. And they're saying, OK, hold on. You're talking to the Arabs and Muslims outside of the United States. Why don't you talk to us, too? We still have some problems. You know, you look at the complaints that they get because, you know, organizations like the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee or the Council on American and Islamic Relations. And they're saying they're still getting the same number of complaints from people when it comes to discrimination.
Is it your experience that the Muslim American debate is where it was when Obama was elected 6 months ago or however many months that was ago, 7 months ago, or do you think it's shifted since then?
Oh, I think it has shifted, and I think what we're hearing is actually the fact that that there's greater expectation, and the greater expectation comes from, you know, once you say this guy is, you know, more on our side, and I think there's some sense of that, there's a sense that also leads to greater expectations. You expect more. You don't expect to stop there. So I think there's been some progress.
Did people get it today, in a word?
Well, you know, I think there were definitely moments in there about, he said, Islam is a part of America. And I think he talked about Muslim Americans' contribution. So I think he was addressing, I think, something for everyone.
Thank you very much, Marcus Mabry, New York Times international business editor, Muna Shikaki, correspondent for Al Arabiya in Washington, D.C., Rami Khoury, the editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Beirut. And now it's time for headlines with Femi Oke.
And that time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. In Asia, two American journalists are apparently starting to move through North Korea's court system. Now, they are charged with illegal entry. They've been in jail since the government picked them up in March. The charges could carry a sentence of up to 18 years in a forced labor camp. Now, at a vigil held on Wednesday in Santa Monica, California, of course, Laura Ling's sister, Lisa, spoke to journalists.
All we can do is hope that the North Korean government will show leniency. You know, if they at any point committed a transgression, then our families are deeply, deeply sorry. And we know the girls are sorry as well. And we hope that the North Korean government acknowledges that and allows them to come home.
And the music you can hear in the background of that little piece of sound is coming from the vigil that was held yesterday for the two journalists who are currently going through a trial in North Korea. That's looking at news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And I'm John Hockenberry. There, you can hear it. Big sports news today. The NBA Finals begin tonight. The Orlando Magic up against the Los Angeles Lakers. It's a big contest. At least half of it was actually predicted by Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, who is our sports contributor here on The Takeaway and who is in the studio. Also a big listener to Barack Obama's speech from Cairo University today. Ibrahim, good morning.
Good morning.
So, first of all, lay out the finals. Barack Obama will probably take a look at them on his way to Europe or when he lands later on tonight.
So in NCAA, there was an Obama bounce when he picked North Carolina, and I'm going to call an Obama bounce in this one because he's picking the Magic.
Really?
No, I'm just joking. He's picking the Lakers in six.
That's a safe bet, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's actually interesting. The format of the finals is 2-3-2, so the team with the best record plays the first two games at home and the last two games at home, providing it's a seven-game series, which makes it extremely difficult for the Magic to be able to compete in a sixth game or a seventh game at L.A. That's going to be very difficult to overcome.
On the momentum game, the Magic is a very tight, very solid team, but they don't have a lot of postseason experience with this personnel. If they win in L.A. in the first game, that's huge for the Magic. Otherwise, I wouldn't expect them to win the first game.
Phil Jackson is 41-0, I believe, in series when his teams win the first game. So I think it's crucial if the Magic want to win, they have to win this first game.
What do you think they need to do to actually make that happen?
Well, they have to do what they have to continue to do what they're doing. They got this guy Pietras, who actually guarded Paul Pierce when they played against the Celtics, guarded LeBron James. I think he's ready actually to take on Kobe Bryant. So they have to put a lot of pressure on Kobe Bryant and make the other players have to step up. Guys like Ariza and Odom have to have big games, and if they do, the Lakers are going to be unstoppable.
Is Orlando's three-point weapon streaky, or do they actually have a method to their madness? Because that's going to be key against Kobe Bryant.
Well, the method to that madness is to dump it into to Superman, Dwight Howard, and when people collapse, just pop it out. All the guys that flank him are all sharpshooters, and I think that their legs are fresh. They're younger guys. In this instance, it gives them the edge on that, and I think they're going to drop those threes.
We've got a minute and a half. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you your reaction to Barack Obama's speech this morning. What do you think?
Well, I was struck by the fact that not only did he mention the past mistakes and past stuff that happened, but Barack Obama also said to the people of the Muslim world what I will call the Ahl Kitab. In Islam, that means the people of the book. And he mentioned that in the last part. He mentioned the part from the Quran, the Torah, and from the Bible. He was speaking to the people of the book. And that made us feel, as Muslims in America and abroad, I would say, a little bit more respected than we felt by presidents in the past.
Let's get real. I mean, did you actually feel a twinge when he said, peace be upon him, referring very specifically to the prophets in a linguistic construct that would be very familiar to Muslims?
It made me think that that the president understands the Muslim world and what's important to the Muslim world. By saying peace be upon all of those prophets, he connected those three traditions, and he said there's actually more in common than not. And I did actually feel a tinge, and it made me – I got a shiver up my spine and said, oh, my president actually understands what's important to me.
Ibrahim, very quickly, the WNBA season gets underway this weekend. Would you like to call the finals right now?
I have
10 seconds, babe.
I'm hoping that the Liberty come out of their dormant slump and come to, you know, to replace the Knicks as the dominant team in New York.
Go Liberty. Go Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports contributor here on The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Andrea Bernstein here with John Hockenberry, and here's Femi Okeh with the headlines.
It's almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. So we're starting to get some reaction from the Muslim world to President Obama's speech in Cairo. A Palestinian official calls the president's support for a Palestinian state an important step. The president also stressed America's ties to Israel and challenged the Muslim world to reject terrorism.
Violence is a dead end. It is a sign neither of courage nor power to shoot rockets at sleeping children or to blow up old women on a bus. That's not how moral authority is claimed. That's how it is surrendered.
The president's speech called for a new beginning between America and the Muslim world, and the president also touched on hotspots including Iran, Afghanistan, and Iraq. We have some new economic data out this morning, and there's some apparently positive news in there. The number of people on the unemployment insurance rolls fell a little bit for the first time in 20 weeks, and the number of people filing for new claims is down as well. A more comprehensive report on the employment picture is coming out tomorrow, and of course we will bring that to you on tomorrow's programme. Now, an array of staff and equipment is on the way to the crash site of the Air France flight from Rio to Paris. Among them is a high-tech sub once used to explore the Titanic wreckage. But bad weather means the search for flight recorders and other clues is being delayed. Now, accident investigators now believe the plane broke apart before crashing into the Atlantic Ocean. It sent a series of automatic messages that seem to signal this. There's no indication as to what caused it, though. The flight recorders could answer some of these questions, but investigators fear they may never find them in the deep, rocky sea. And finally, it's been 20 years since the deadly military crackdown on protesters in Tiananmen Square in China. The government has the area packed with police to stop any demonstrations, and there's strict control of news coverage and websites inside of China. The final death toll will never be known, but could be in the thousands. Let's look at all your stories from the headlines for this morning. John, Andrea.
Thanks, Femi. It's budget mayhem in California.
Healthcare is right! Budget cuts are wrong! Healthcare is right! Budget cuts are wrong!
That's the sound of members of Planned Parenthood in downtown Los Angeles Tuesday, protesting Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's proposed budget cuts to try and get California out of its crippling debt.
We have no time to waste. The controller has told us that we have 14 days to act, or California is at risk of running out of cash. I've already used my executive authority to reduce the state payroll, and I've proposed the necessary cuts to the three largest areas of our budget, which is education, healthcare, and prisons.
That is, of course, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. With us now is Patricia Nazario, a health, housing, and immigration reporter for KPCC in Southern California. And also joining us is Crystal Morales, a specialist coordinator for Altamed. Oh, not yet, Crystal. We hope to have her later in the segment. Let's start with Patricia. How did it get so bad in California in the first place?
Well, there's a backstory. You know, when Arnold Schwarzenegger first took office in 2003, the first thing he did was cut this car tax that we had. It was a big promise that he ran on, and it was his first order of business. But that cut was about $3.6 billion a year. And if you calculate that over the 7 years he's been in office, it's pretty much what this debt is. We're looking at about $24 billion. So that's part of it. But the other part is politicians put to voters last month a series of propositions to try and cobble together some money to fill this debt, and voters rejected them.
Now, did they reject them because they didn't want to fix the budget, because they didn't understand what they meant, or because they actually just outright thought they were a bad idea?
I think voters are frustrated, disgusted, maybe some apathy there. There were people who just don't believe anything at this point. The propositions ranged everything from establishing a rainy day fund. Voters said no. There was another one that would establish some funds for schools and universities. Voters said no. Another one said we can borrow against future lottery income. Voters said no. And then there was another one that would have dipped into these programs for children, for health and mental health of children that are doing well and have surpluses. It would have taken those surpluses and moved them to the general fund so that we could help fill this gap. And voters just flat out said no. The only one that did pass was one that limited elected official salaries in any deficit year.
And to be clear, I mean, you know, Californians have this historic aversion to new taxes. I mean, facing things that, you know, the things that we heard Governor Schwarzenegger say, we're going to cut health care. I understand that we're looking at, huge cuts in the health care program for the poor, a shorter school year. Californians would rather face all of these things than think about new taxes?
I think that has to do with the politicians in Sacramento. California has this two-thirds majority requirement in order to get taxes passed. And Democrats have held the majority, and they have in the House and Senate for a long time, but it's not the majority that they need. It's not two-thirds. So they can't just pass taxes like that. And the Republicans in power are very anti-tax. So there's always this struggle, and it makes it almost impossible to come to some sort of budget agreement in Sacramento. And I think that's probably the basis of it. Californians, I think, as people are very willing to give. I mean, the reason politicians had to come back to voters with these propositions is because voters voted on these things and created these funds in the first place.
Now,
before they could change that, they had to come back to them.
You cover health and housing. I mean, are you reporting actually on people that are making preparations for these cuts, or are people still in denial?
I think on the ground, people are still in denial or just not paying attention. What I am seeing, though, is grassroots movement. I'm seeing coalitions, and I'm seeing grassroots organizers and activists really, really mobilizing. I mean, they're joining forces. They're splitting the expense of sending families up to Sacramento so that moms and dads and children can talk to politicians, at least have some time to plead their case. I mean, what I'm seeing is all these people, as you started the sound at the top with Planned Parenthood, these organizations are coming out and saying, not on my turf. You know, yes, maybe there has to be some cuts, but there are also some revenue income streams that a lot of these activists want the governor to look at. And he's not looking at them because he's a Republican and they're basically anti-tax.
Patricia, you describe a system in California, which is already, you know, the largest state. So it's unusual for that reason. But the
sixth largest economy in the world or something
exactly.
Like that?
Yeah, exactly. Huge. But the political situation seems to give enormous power to the minority. I'm just wondering if there's any way to extrapolate the experience of California out to the rest of the nation, because there are fiscal problems in state capitals all over the United States. Or is this California's own headache?
Wow, that's an enormous question. I'm sure that you could find parallels across the country. I think what makes it unique in California is this two-thirds majority. And, you know, they try to come together, these politicians, just before this special election. The governor and the Speaker of the House went to African-American churches because African-Americans generally vote conservatively. So they tried to get three or four huge churches to come on board and to support these propositions, and it failed. So there's maybe some states struggle more with racial issues or historically racial issues. I think with California, we see a lot of this pull and tug with the two political sides.
Patricia, do people in California, are they accepting that they're looking at children getting thrown off health care and shorter school years and probably most shocking to the middle class, the closure of California's famous parks in a nutshell?
You know, people are doubting if it can happen. It's such a strange time, and maybe this is all part, it's like this, you know, rolling avalanche. We're just not sure how big it's going to get or where it's going to go or when it's going to stop. I mean, some critics say, oh, he's bluffing. Oh, he's not going to close the parks, because why would he do that? It's a minimal cost to maintain, and they draw in like $8 billion a year from the tourists and the people who go camp there and patronize communities around those parks. But, you know, the governor has also talked about selling off high-profile state assets like the L.A. Memorial Coliseum, for example.
We will find out. We will check in with you again. Thank you very much, Patricia Nazario, reporter for Health, Immigration, and Housing for KPCC in Southern California. Thanks so much.
I guess the takeaway there is don't play political chicken with a rolling avalanche. I love that. President Obama gave a speech in Cairo today that's also in the news. It's intended to redefine America's relations with the Muslim world. What's your response to it? Is it a powerful enough speech to change our Middle East diplomacy?
Good morning. My name is Amna. I'm calling from New Jersey. I think he did an excellent job of showing religious sensitivity. I do think, however, he needs to state it more clearly. The Israeli contribution to the problem in Palestine is a cause of their anger. And it seemed to me as if he was saying it was more like the Palestinian contribution that needs to be dealt with. And I don't think that's the case.
Too balanced, or what direction do you think Barack Obama should have gone in his speech? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've been getting reaction from around the world. We love to share your reaction. You can view blog posts from some of the reactors to Barack Obama's speech on our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Obama speaks. Was the Muslim world listening?
I see the snarky comments on the web already, swiping at him over this or that, but the truth is, he was more inspiring to me than any mullah that I've heard from my pulpit at any mosque.
Reaction from Asra Nomani, journalism professor at Georgetown University and author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Breathing the dust of the pyramids, U.S. President Barack Obama outlines his hope for the future of the Middle East. Reacting to Obama on the Nile, It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Well, he's been there and he's done that. Barack Obama in Cairo, Egypt. It's Thursday, June 4th, just after 4 in the afternoon in Cairo. I'm John Hockenberry here with Andrea Bernstein. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll have everything you need to know about the president's speech with analysis and reaction from around the world. Plus, 20 years later, we'll talk to a photographer who took one of the most iconic images of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. It's the photo of Tank Man, the unnamed lone protester who stopped a column of Chinese tanks. All this and more, but first, the morning's headlines.
And in the headlines, Barack Obama's speech in Cairo today touched on several Middle East hotspots. He talked about Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. The American troop presence in Afghanistan is growing, but he says it won't be permanent.
Make no mistake, we do not want to keep our troops in Afghanistan. We see no military, we seek no military bases there.
There were numerous applause lines in the speech in Cairo, which went about an hour this morning. Barack Obama called for a new beginning between America and the Muslim world and stressed that Muslims are welcome in the U.S.
Let there be no doubt, Islam is a part of America.
The president now heads to Europe. He'll meet with leaders and later mark the 65th anniversary of D-Day.
New economic reporting is just out this hour, and there's some positive or apparent positive news there. The number of people on the unemployment insurance rolls fell a bit for the first time in 20 weeks, and the number of people filing for new claims is down as well. A more comprehensive report on the employment picture is coming tomorrow, and we'll bring it to you then on The Takeaway. An array of staff and equipment is on the way to the crash site of the Air France flight from Rio to Paris. Among them is a high-tech sub once used to explore the Titanic wreckage. But bad weather means the search for flight recorders and other clues is delayed. Investigators fear they may never find the recorders in the deep, rocky sea.
Two American journalists are apparently starting to move through North Korea's court system. That's according to reports coming out of Russia. They're charged with illegal entry. They've been in jail since the government picked them up in March. The charges could carry a sentence of up to 10 years in a forced labor camp. The NBA finals start tonight. The Orlando Magic visit the Los Angeles Lakers. The S&P and the Dow both dipped yesterday, but that positive economic news Andrea was speaking about means a positive opening on Wall Street in about 30 minutes. The Obama speech is really the reaction we're getting from around the world is very, very positive, and we'd love to get some reaction from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now that we can take a breath here, what's your reaction?
My reaction is it had something for almost everyone, and having heard an awful lot of Obama's speech during the campaign, I am only reaffirmed in thinking he's a master of the craft.
It's a global political campaign speech. That
it
was
sure
the thought
is.
That came to me.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry in with Andrea Bernstein. It was a comprehensive and I think it's fair to say emotionally charged speech in Cairo, Egypt earlier today. Wouldn't you agree?
State Department translated the speech into 13 languages, Twittered it, put it on MySpace and Facebook. It was clearly something, a little something directed to everyone. Lots of emotion and lots of tough love.
A moment really that attests to the technological features of our age and also the considerable rhetorical skills of Barack Obama. We're going to summarize the speech and take a look at reaction around the world with our guests here in the studio. But we want to give you the send-off, the kind of final religious cadence. And it was really quite emotional at the end of the speech. This is what Barack Obama said at the conclusion in Cairo, Egypt.
We have the power to make the world we seek, but only if we have the courage to make a new beginning, keeping in mind what has been written. The Holy Quran tells us, O mankind, we have created you, male and a female, and we have made you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another. The Talmud tells us the whole of the Torah
is for the purpose of promoting peace. The Holy Bible tells us, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." The people of the world can live together in peace. We know that is God's vision. Now that must be our work here on earth. Thank you. And may God's peace be upon you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
There, the emotional ending of Barack Obama speaking to students and dignitaries and religious clergy from the Islamic world at the Cairo University and members of the faculty of Al-Azhar University. That was the conclusion of his speech, a nearly hour-long address, comprehensive. He spoke about Iraq, Afghanistan. He spoke about the areas of commonality between the Muslim world and the West. He spoke a lot about history, both American history and world history. And we have reaction all hour long here on The Takeaway with the Professor Peter Ahn, who's the Director of Middle East Studies at Columbia University. And we're going to reprise bits of that speech all hour long. Also, Noah Feldman is with us. He's a professor of law at Harvard University and author of The Fall and Rise of the Islamic State. He's in Boston. And Andrea Bernstein, of course, my co-host, will be with us the whole way. First of all, Professor Peter Ahn, reaction, quite simply.
I think it's a momentous speech. I think we're in a new age of foreign policy for the United States. It had two important things. I think general principles, reaching out to the Islamic world, and then reiterating some very, very hard realities for Israelis and Palestinians. I think his notion of having faith in other people, seeing other people as equals, respecting each other's cultures and religion, was absolutely critical.
We were speaking before the speech about whether President Obama could speak to a billion Muslims around the world. To what extent do you think he was effective to making a speech to a global audience?
If I have a criticism, it's that there is the underlying presumption that all Muslims are observant. In fact, the vast majority of Muslims, like in any religious tradition, are far more culturally identified as Muslims than necessarily observant of Islamic law, or they pray, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a sense that you're missing a really large segment of the Muslim population by presenting such a religiously charged speech.
Although, in speaking about women's rights and secular successes economically in the Muslim world, he certainly does tip the hat to people who might not view religion as the most important thing in their lives. Noah Feldman, it seems to me that this speech has two big themes. One is very much a diplomatic theme. All of the hot spots were covered and spoken about. But it also seems to address specifically the kind of language that is used between the West and the Muslim world, an attempt to rewrite the discourse. What do you think, Noah?
Well, President Obama said very explicitly in the beginning of his speech that he wanted straight talk, and he also wanted to talk about overlap. And I think he did a good job with the latter. He really did try here to talk about values, ideas that are shared across, broadly speaking, the West, and broadly speaking, the Muslim world. I think that was pretty effective, and I think you heard the enthusiasm for that in the audience. I think when it came to the specifics in the talk, it's a pretty thin speech, and I think in terms of specific policy points, it's not a game changer. It's essentially telling people in the Muslim world, this is our policy, these are the reasons for our policy. We mean well, and we hope that you'll trust our, or at least my, good intentions.
All right, well, let's get some examples exactly of what you are talking about. First, this is a bit of the history, a bit of the symbolism, and a bit of the atmospherics. Wouldn't you agree? Listen to this.
When the first Muslim American was recently elected to Congress, he took the oath to defend our Constitution using the same Holy Quran that one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, kept in his personal library.
All right, there's atmospherics, but we also have some specifics where he referred specifically to a two-state solution in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Here's Barack Obama a little later on in that speech.
On the other hand, it is also undeniable that the Palestinian people, Muslims and Christians, has suffered in pursuit of a homeland.
There were lots of references to Israel in there, Afghanistan and Iraq. Are you saying, Noah Feldman, that this was an on the one hand, on the other hand style of speaking where he covers bases but doesn't really move anything forward?
I don't know if I would have exactly said not moving anything forward, but I do think that, for example, he's not the first president to speak specifically about the suffering of the Palestinian people. It's good that he mentioned it. He reaffirmed at the exact same time that the Holocaust is real and that the Israelis have a right to security. Again, familiar positions from an American president. He again said that Hamas, if it wants to participate in the peace process, you know, has to honor prior agreements and renounce violence. Again, very much the American policy as it's been. So he reached out in, I think, very creative and sophisticated ways rhetorically. But I don't think on the substance there was really anything new that I heard in the speech.
But Noah Feldman, I mean, isn't part of this about sort of galvanizing, you know, sort of worldwide attention? I mean, I know that when people hear speeches, and a lot of times when I hear speeches, I think, oh, I didn't hear very much new. But on the other hand, I know I'm paying very close attention. To people around the world who aren't paying close attention, to have this wrapped up in one package, doesn't that in itself have a effect of sort of moving the ball down the field?
It does if the general goal is a positive sense of goodwill while people give him a chance to wait and see what he'll accomplish. And I think he did do that. But we have to remember that when former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice went to Cairo a couple of years ago, she said for the first time that our policies in the Middle East had tried to produce stability and at the expense of freedom and democracy, and we had really failed. And President Bush said our Middle East policies in the past had been wrong. And, you know, people were excited when they said those things, too, but they obviously, in much of the Muslim world in the Middle East, were extremely upset with the policies of the Bush administration.
Right. I mean, the Bush administration was actively pursuing the war in Iraq. They were actively defending Guantanamo. Those were things that Obama got a lot of applause today, saying he was going to change and end. And he went to great lengths to make a distinction about the war in Iraq being a war of choice versus the war in Afghanistan.
Yes, he distanced himself remarkably from the war in Iraq, given that we're still fighting that war, given that to say that we'll remove troops is not the same as saying we don't actually have them there at the moment. So that was, again, a very sophisticated piece of rhetoric. But we still have a policy on the ground of being involved in Iraq, and we still have to remain involved in Iraq for a little while.
Certainly, there's an indication in the reaction in the hall, Peter, that people are paying attention to these lines specifically related to Afghanistan, Iraq, and the hotspots in the world. Nail down and give me a sense, I saw you nodding during the whole speech, of the applause lines and their significance here.
No, absolutely. I think he's setting benchmarks to demonstrate the consistency he will have, hopefully, in his Middle East policy. I think the Bush administration was caught in a kind of schizophrenic bind. They were engaged militarily in unpopular intrusions in the Islamic world, and yet they were talking about previously failed policies. And there was no consistency.
How important do you think the setting is here in terms of gauging Islamic or Arab reaction here?
I think, again, for the Arab world, Cairo has always been, and Egypt, the central power base, though that has decreased, I would say, in recent years. But it's an immensely populous country, I think still has a great deal of power, and it's an important spot to do this.
Timing, content, reactions to President Barack Obama's speech in Cairo, Egypt, from Professor Peter Ahn, Director of the Middle East Studies Program at Columbia University, and Noah Feldman, Professor of Law at Harvard. And we'd love to include your reaction to the reactions we're getting from around the world.
For me, Obama's speech triumphs not because all of those wonderful goals he referred to will be realized, but rather simply because Obama is favorably and attractively packaging and presenting us to the world.
Your thoughts at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. And President Obama, of course, spoke this morning at Cairo University. His next stop is Europe. And there's much news in the world besides the president's speech. But as we do on Monday mornings, we thought we'd ask Marcus Mabry, who's been our guest in reaction to the speech all morning long, international business editor for The New York Times, to see if this speech and some of the interesting themes that were developed in this speech sort of changes the agenda, maybe changes the message from what we were talking about at the beginning of this week, which was the bankruptcy of General Motors. Is this the message changer, Marcus Mabry?
Well, I would say I take the easy way out and say temporarily, absolutely. The fact is what the news will be dominated by for the rest of this week and through the weekend will be reaction to the speech from around the world, and not just from the Arab world, as well as we haven't really heard from Israelis yet. We'll be hearing a lot from what Israelis think. We'll also be hearing a lot from the Republican opposition, which I think will probably say some of this stuff was a little too conciliatory. And then the rest of the week will also be dominated by tomorrow's monthly jobless numbers.
And we already have some positive numbers. The weekly jobless claims were down. The total number of new filings were down for the first time in 20 weeks. Are we at the bottom of a trend? Unclear. We'll certainly get the other indicator at the end of the week when we get the monthly numbers. But give us a sense of what this tone in Barack Obama's speech to so-called the Muslim world, but does to a domestic audience here.
There must be a sustained effort to listen to each other, to learn from each other, to respect one another, and to seek common ground. As the Holy Quran tells us, be conscious of God and speak always the truth.
Sounds like a bumper sticker.
Well, you know, this is the power of this particular politician, this Obama, this biracial American president, his power to look at both sides, his power to even disarm opponents to some extent by letting them hear that he understands their arguments and their voices. This is a guy who is all about conciliation. He's about bringing together supposedly opposing sides, as he has in his own personal
life.
And
it's a complex interweaving. I mean, he goes off to Buchenwald, something he referred to in his speech, which is an explicit sort of reference to Israeli concerns about their sensitivities being taken into consideration in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And plus, he's got the D-Day anniversary in Europe. What's that going to mean?
It's going to be, you know, we heard this historical resonance in what he said. And it was interesting because Rami Kouri, who's one of the great intellectuals in Lebanon.
Beirut Star editor who spoke on this program earlier this morning.
And recently, and he said the speech was pedantic. That was the negative word he used about it. And I agree with him. There were parts that were so professorial where he was kind of lecturing and presenting things somewhat simplistically, a critic might say, with a certain American naivete about how things could evolve in the Middle East. But he did draw on history a lot here, as any professor would, and he's going to be doing that again when he gets to Europe, connecting America's past, America's triumphs over oppression, especially Nazi oppression, which obviously he talked about at some length this morning, addressed really to the ridiculousness of Holocaust denialism. But he will also be connecting that to America's promise today, not just to our country, but to the world. That's what he's going to be doing this week.
One of the things that Rami Kouri took umbrage of in the speech was President Obama's reference to 9/11. But I'm wondering if that doesn't inoculate him in some way against some American criticism. And as evidence of this, I present to you that what just minutes after the jobs report is out, I have an email in my inbox from the Republican National Committee research arm, which is the opposition research, saying, where are the jobs? And it's an attack on the unemployment numbers. We have been finished with a speech for more than 2 hours and still no response from the Republican Party. Makes me think, and I'm wondering if you agree, that the Republicans aren't sure how to react to this speech.
I think you're exactly right. Until the last administration, there was a real kind of, since the end of World War II, a consensus in Washington that whatever differences Americans had, they stopped at the water's edge. Now, there were certainly differences of opinion over the years over foreign policy, but they were really exacerbated and exaggerated to an extent we had not seen in generations in the Bush administration. I think the Republicans are reacting to that. They don't want to seem like they're just poking the president gratuitously.
My sense is they're terrified to actually go near it. I think they don't want to be any part of this sort of thing. But I'm wondering if there was a way for them to react, it would be in this particular domain. Marcus, listen to this.
It is agonizing for America to lose our young men and women. It is costly and politically difficult to continue this conflict. We would gladly bring every single one of our troops home if we could be confident that there were not violent extremists in Afghanistan and now Pakistan, determined to kill as many Americans as they possibly can. But that is not yet the case.
Marcus Mabry, when does this sort of abstract recounting of America's need to be in these hotspots, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, become a real war issue for Americans? When are the troops coming home, and when can we stop paying for these wars?
Well, it's interesting because I think that line was actually directed to Americans more than to anyone else. And, and it was saying to us that we can't come home. We can't stop spending these trillions of dollars until we know that we will be safe. And, of course, one could argue that that day will never come, a day where we can be certain we'll be safe. And what he was arguing for is how much he's going to continue to spend in Afghanistan, however much we can draw down in Iraq.
At the beginning of the week, and we were just talking about GM, these new job numbers, do you think that they're going to sort of help sort of do what the president wants, which is sort of get the economy off the table, or is there just not enough good economic news to really change the subject?
Well, you know, we've been seeing this tug of war between the bears and the bulls, between positive economic signs of quote-unquote green shoots of recovery and negative economic signs. For instance, tomorrow we'll probably see a number of, 550, probably 600,000 Americans who are still losing their jobs, new people unemployed. This tug of war will continue. I don't think these numbers will be enough to say that we've bottomed out and we're going upward. We don't know when that point is going to come. Frankly, we don't know what signs there will be to know for sure we've reached bottom. But I think right now that tug of war is going to continue, and the answer is not yet given.
Although, the conspiratorial scenario is the White House called up the Department of Labor and said, just tell us what the unemployment numbers are, and it will be safe. And if they're positive, then we can leave for Cairo. And if they're not, so it looks like he's definitely got a blip.
I can say with definitiveness, this trip was planned long before.
Yeah, well, you never know. You never call us off. Call us off Cairo. All right. Finally, we are so used to hearing really, really bad news. Does Barack Obama have a benefit that even if it is pretty miserable on Friday, he can still say, steady as she goes, things aren't coming off the rails here?
Oh, I think so. The expectation is such that Americans don't expect things are going to be. We're going to see a low number tomorrow. So I think he benefits from that. I think the curse for Barack Obama, and this is true both in foreign policy after what was generally conceived to be a very good speech today, and also true in the economic numbers, the curse of rising expectations. The problem is there will become a point when people expect things to be improving in both those realms, and if they're not, then he's going to have a price to pay. That's I think the real.
So the White House is sort of. That's my takeaway. Praying for low expectations to continue. That's their cover.
It's the Obama
way.
Exactly. Doing it in the past. Absolutely, talk things down.
Marcus Mabry, that's sort of the mini agenda midweek here. New York Times International Business Editor. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Andrea Bernstein with John Hockenberry and Femi Okeh with the latest news.
Thank you very much. Always good to hear my name said twice.
Femi Okeh.
Thank you so much. 28 minutes to the top of the hour. You made me happy. So the big story of the morning, President Obama's speech in Cairo today. It touched on several Middle East hotspots, and he talked about Iran, Afghanistan, also Iraq. The president says that America's military presence is not permanent in Iraq.
I have made it clear to the Iraqi people that we pursue no bases and no claim on their territory or resources. Iraq's sovereignty is its own.
The president's speech included calls for common ground and support for a Palestinian state, but it also challenges the Islamic world to end violence and threats to Israel. In the United States, new economic reporting is just out this morning, and there's apparently some good news. The number of people on unemployment insurance rolls fell a bit for the first time in 20 weeks, and the number of people filing new jobless claims down as well. An international body is clearing way for Cuba to join after nearly half a century of being suspended. The Organization of American States is made up of Western Hemisphere countries, including the United States. The latest vote means that Cuba could rejoin the group. The U.S. lobbied for human rights requirements before the vote, but ultimately the OAS voted to lift the Cuban ban without any conditions. In sports, the NBA Finals start tonight. The Orlando Magic visit the Los Angeles Lakers in the best-of-seven series. Hockey's Stanley Cup Final is also underway. The Detroit Red Wings visit the Pittsburgh Penguins tonight. Detroit leads the series 2-1. Also, check out our sports correspondent Ibrahim Abdul-Martin to see his predictions for the seven-game series in the NBA Finals. You'll find that at thetakeaway.org. And finally, many big anniversaries today on June the 4th. I've talked about some of them in the news. The one I haven't mentioned is John Hockenberry's birthday.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
You're kidding me. Yeah. You've been holding out all this time?
This just in. Only the newscaster can break this news.
It's a bunch bigger
Happy
news day
birthday,
in China.
John.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, now we're busy. Got to react back to the news. Andrea,
much, Femi.
Important stuff.
Thank you, Femi. We've been hearing reaction all morning on Obama's speech. Here's John.
I had no idea the speech by President Obama would evoke such emotion in me. For so long, we've been holding up this clenched fist of fear and anger. And to listen to a president show the heart and soul of the American people to the rest of the world, and that we're all in this together.
Our partners at the BBC have also been getting a lot of reaction. Joining us is Madeline Morris. She's from the BBC's World Have Your Say. They're devoting today's programs to the speech. Madeline, what are you hearing?
Hi, Andrea. Hi, John. Yes, we're getting absolutely inundated here at the BBC with this sort of, with all of your reactions to President Obama's speech. So let me start off with the positive. It is, as you would imagine, a mixed bag. Here are some positive tweets on Twitter. This from T.C. Morrison. Watching Obama's Cairo speech following global reactions on Twitter, both are riveting regardless of one's ideology and precedented. Trisignia on Twitter says, watching Barack Obama's Cairo address, he's making me proud to be an American in the Middle East. And Lynn H. says, Obama shows once again the eloquence and reflectiveness that got him elected. Great speech in Cairo. Now, as you've been talking about, it's a very wide-ranging speech, and lots of people seem to have been surprised at the range of issues he was prepared to address. I was waiting to throw in his favourite recipes for cookies, actually. It was so wide-ranging. not everyone was...
Or John Huckenberry's birthday cake.
Oh, John Hockenberry's birthday cake.
Oh, the price
happy
of
birthday.
Tin. What about that? Thank you very much.
Yes, some glaring omissions there from President Obama, actually. This is from Victor Kay. He talked about President Obama's overconfidence, as he put it. He says, a speech exemplifying all the faults of Obama's liberal left, one worldist view, the belief that a solution exists for every problem and that government action is the solution to all problems, dishing out unsolicited advice to other countries about how they should order their social and political affairs. Do Muslims lecture the US, say, on abortion? Check in a year from now. The speech won't have made a blind bit of difference to anything in the real world. And this from Kamal to our blog, worldhaveyoursay.com. He says, why is Obama shaking hands with Saudis and Egyptians whilst preaching democracy to Iran, Cuba and a China? Please get real.
Those are good responses. Those are actually really good, solid responses.
Madeline, there were a lot of sort of emotional trigger points for different audiences. There was, of course, the reference to Buchenwald. There was the reference to people who died in 9/11. There was reference to Palestinian aspirations for a homeland. There was even reference to the CIA's role in overthrowing, in the middle of the last century, Iran's democratic government. I'm wondering if you are seeing in your response any patterns of, you know, sort of responding or connecting to those emotional high points from different areas around the world.
I think what's touching the biggest nerve, actually, is his approach to Palestinians and Israelis and what he said about those. He, of course, said that Israel's ties with America were unbreakable, but he also said, I forget the exact word that he used, but that the treatment of Palestinians, their situation was intolerable, I think was his word. This is sort of indicative of the result of what we've been getting. On the BBC's Have Your Say site, this is the most recommended comment. It's It's from Dean in Toronto, and he says, can Obama open a dialogue? Let's get real. I mean, really real, not a bunch of propaganda. After 3 years of constant negotiation sponsored by Arabs in Egypt, the Palestinians living in the West Bank, Fatah can't even create a dialogue with Palestinians living in Gaza. End of story. And this is the second most commented and recommended. This is from P. Cola. He doesn't say where he is. He says, how does one make peace with folks whose avowed goal is the total annihilation of a nation? The issue isn't parceling out bits of land. It's the simple, unalterable fact that Arabs cannot, will not, and have not accepted a Jewish state in their midst since 1948. So, you know, we are getting lots of plaudits and lots of people saying, lots of Americans in particular, saying that this speech makes them proud to be American. But there is certainly quite an amount of criticism out there. And if you've got a second, I've just had my colleague bring in some comment which has come in to our Arabic news site, which is on BBC Arabic. Have you got time for me to read out a few
of those? Go ahead.
Sure. This is from Ezat in Cairo. He says, an eloquent speech with carefully chosen words. He made sure not to clash with the dictatorial regimes. It's a highly political and diplomatic speech, but nothing should be expected from it. And this from Hashem in Saudi Arabia. We need to respond to Mr. Obama's speech with an open mind and not prejudge him, but we also can't completely depend on him to solve our own problems.
Madeline, let's play one quick tape response we got, and then let me see the answer to your last question if you've heard more of this.
I thought it was interesting that Obama began his speech by quoting the Quran. As a Christian, he must be aware of St. Paul's injunction to be all things to all men. And I believe he has the ability to do that.
Finally, Madeline, did you hear any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've had some people responding to the fact that he did quote from the Quran. This is from Stephen Bostom. He says, Obama is a guy who tries to please everyone, and we all know how that turns out.
Yeah, it could be a pejorative or a compliment. That's really, really interesting.
I think Stephen Boston probably means it as the pejorative.
So far, judging from World Have Your Say, it seems like the world is saying A-OK. Thanks very much, Madeline Morris, from our partners, the BBC.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Andrea Bernstein. Family members are continuing to mourn the loss of 228 passengers aboard Air France Flight 447 that crashed into the Atlantic Ocean on its way to Paris from Brazil on Sunday. Meanwhile, French officials are expressing concern that the black box recorders from the plane may never be recovered. That's because of the mountainous terrain deep beneath the sea. Joining us now is Captain Patrick Keenan. He is the U.S. Navy Director of Ocean Engineering and the Supervisor of the Salvage and Diving for the Navy. He knows what it's like to search in similar conditions for black boxes. He's joining us from his office in Washington. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, John and Andrea.
So I'm wondering, as I'm sort of listening to the French investigators say, we don't think we can find this, it certainly sounds to me as if, you know, this is sort of buried in, say, the Himalayan mountain range under the sea. Can it really ever be found?
Well, it certainly will be a challenge. There is not in any of these open ocean aircraft wreckage recoveries, not one particular, but there have been multiple operations like this in the past. The biggest challenge is location. Obviously, you cannot recover wreckage until you've located it.
How do you go about locating a wreckage in these kind of very difficult conditions?
Well, there are multiple methods. I'll explain two of them now. You can tow behind a ship in your search probable area a piece of equipment called a towed pinger locator. The black boxes, which are the flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorders, have attached to them acoustic beacons. And these beacons put out a signal at 37.5 kilohertz, and that beacon lasts for approximately 30 days, is active for approximately 30 days after immersion.
And how close do you have to get to such a beacon to hear it?
Approximately approximately 1 mile. You need to get your towed pinger locator approximately 1 mile from the beacon. So you need to tow this if you're in deep water. Obviously, if you're at more than a mile deep water, then you can't be on the surface and hear it. And so you tow in a search pattern based on estimates of the most high probability area where you believe wreckage would be. And in addition to the pinger locator, which is completely passive, so it's a hydrophone and it is not putting any sound into the water, you can also use a side scan sonar, also towed from a ship. The side scan sonar actively pulses the seabed with sound energy, attains the reflection, and then based on that information can perform a mapping of the seabed, and you can find anomalies such as wreckage.
Are you optimistic that it will be found in this case?
Well, in this case, I don't have enough information to be either optimistic or pessimistic, because at this point in time, the U.S. Navy salvage forces are not involved in this recovery.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much, Captain Patrick Keenan, the U.S. Navy Director of Ocean Engineering and the Supervisor of Salvage and Diving for the Navy. Thanks so much for joining us from your office in Washington this morning.
Of course, it's probably smart that they didn't have the black boxes painted black. They're actually orange.
But they don't float.
If they did find them, right.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A 20-year anniversary in China when we come back. But first, Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thanks, John. Almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama called for a fresh start between Americans and the Muslims around the world in a speech he made in Cairo today. He spoke about the need for mutual respect and open dialogue. The president also spoke about the role of women.
I do not believe that women must make the same choices as men in order to be equal. And I respect those women who choose to live their lives in traditional roles. But it should be their choice.
The president now heads to Europe to take part in D-Day commemoration events. In other international news, today Iran marks 20 years since the death of the Islamic State's founder, Ayatollah Khomeini. There are ceremonies today. Iran's current supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has a very similar name, sometimes leading to confusion, which I hope I've managed to avoid. Back in the U.S., same-sex couples in New Hampshire can start planning weddings. The governor's signature on a new bill means that gay marriages can take place as early as January, and New Hampshire becomes the sixth state with four gay marriage
rights. You know, Femi, nothing says wedding bells like New Hampshire in January.
People leave New Hampshire for, what is it, December, January, February, March, April, come back maybe May.
Maybe they're going to Iowa.
Maybe. Well, there's skiing weddings. I mean,
yeah, it's nice. It's such a nice skiing up there. Little chilly.
Chestnuts roasting.
Do you pack in my bags?
I have one more story. This one's a good one, actually.
I was going to quiz you on Iran there.
No, not yet. Hold your fire. Finally, a medical breakthrough for dogs. The Food and Drug Administration has approved the first drug developed specifically to treat cancer in dogs. So the drug is called Palladia, and it can be used to treat skin-based cancer like tumours, for instance. And the drug is a major breakthrough for veterinary medicine, because vets usually have to rely on drugs used to treat human cancer without knowing if those drugs will be safe or effective on dogs. So that's a look at your news and your headlines for this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Femi. In the spring of 1989, I remember turning on my TV and watching the death of a pro-democracy official spark a series of student protests in China. Over 100,000 protesters gathered in Tiananmen Square in the heart of Beijing, and the government was very wary. This went on for days. Work strikes and demonstrations continued, and a mass hunger strike began. The government finally had enough, so they sent in the army. Late at night on June 3, 1989, tanks rolled into the crowded square. By June 4th, it was over. Tiananmen Square was clear. Reports of casualties varied widely. To help recreate the scene, we are joined by Kate Ady, a BBC reporter who was there 20 years ago. Kate Ady joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also joining us now is Jeff Widener from Hawaii. He shot the famous photo of a lone man clad in a white shirt standing down a tank. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Kate Ady. Can you sort of recreate the scene from the time? What do you remember? What was your what were you witnessing at that time?
I was out for 5 hours that evening, going out just before midnight, having heard that shots had been fired miles away from Tiananmen Square. And with my camera crew, I roamed around for 5 hours, and I saw more people killed than I have ever witnessed, and some were killed standing right next to me. Soldiers on trucks fired indiscriminately at ordinary citizens coming out of their houses, woken by the sound of tanks. People who just peered round the corner, going home from work late from various places, they too got caught. People were shot in their houses through the thin clay walls of their little houses. It was slaughter, and none of them were armed. The tanks got right to Tiananmen Square eventually with APCs behind them, and the students were slowly pushed out of the square, but not before. At 4:15, I'd witnessed volleys of shots which did not go over the heads, which were not rubber bullets, as the students had thought. They were live rounds.
Kate Ady, we do have that clip from 20 years ago. Here it is.
After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government."
And I believe that is the moment that you were at in your story. Also joining us from Hawaii is Jeff Widener. Jeff, you took the famous picture of a man facing down a tank. Tell us how you got that shot.
I'd received a massive concussion from a rock that hit me probably in the early morning hours of June 4th. So I was kind of spaced out, and I was trying to sleep it off. The next morning I came into the AP office, which is located at the diplomatic compound, and there was a message from AP New York saying that they didn't want anybody to take any unnecessary risks, but if somebody could please photograph the occupied Tiananmen Square, they'd appreciate it.
That's always the journalist's dilemma. Don't endanger yourself, but go get the story. So you did.
So, you know, I was pretty shaken up from the concussion. I was sick as a dog with a flu, and now I had to take a bicycle, go out in the street again, and, you know, I'm weaving around all these burned-out buses and rocks in the ground, and I had to go all the way to the Beijing Hotel because that was really the best vantage point to even have a chance of getting the occupied square. And I'd heard rumors that, journalists had had their film confiscated and been beaten up and even had electric cattle prods used on them. So I hid all my camera equipment inside of my Levi jacket, hid the film in my underwear, and I basically went through the lobby like I was just, you know, a normal, visitor there. And I had to think quickly because they had a lot of security and white robes, you know, these like gowns things. And so I just saw this young kid named Kirk, and I walked up to him and I said, "Hi, Joe, where you been?" And then I whispered, "You know, I'm from AP. Can you let me up to your room?" So he picked it up real quick, and then the security guys figured I was with him and they left. Got up to the room, and then he helped me eventually get up to the roof and get the picture of the occupied Tiananmen Square. And I was shooting a lot of things. You know, they were bringing dead and dying in the street below on little carts. And buses would plow through these buses that were burned out in the street. And finally, I ran out of film. And I just asked Kurt, you know, "Listen, can you help me out? Because I can't go out and look like a journalist." So he went out, and he about an hour later came back with one roll of film. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, well, okay, load the camera. And I basically took a nap. And then hear the sound of tanks coming down the street. So I go to the balcony, and I'm thinking, well, this is a nice composition. And And then all of a sudden, this guy runs out with shopping bags, and I told Kurt, this guy's going to screw up my picture, you know, because the composition. So he says, you know, they're going to kill that guy. And then, you know, I'm looking and thinking, you know, when are they going to shoot him? And I'm just waiting for that instant. He's obviously going to get shot, and nothing happens. So I look back at the bed where I have a doubler, and this would increase the focal length of my lens. It would double. It's like a pair of binoculars is 10 times. It would go to 20 times. You just get closer view. The question is, do I gamble? Do I go back? You know.
And what happened?
I went for it, and I put it on, and I got three shots off. And then it was over. Some people came and whisked them away.
And that was the famous photo. Kate, where were you?
We were all. There was about 50 of us on the balconies of the Beijing Hotel with television cameras. And when he came out, we were absolutely staggered. Earlier, we had been there. I mean, we'd been there overnight. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, at 9, 8, at 10, 20, there were volleys of shots in front of us in the hotel. We saw people shot dead in front of us. It was quite, quite dreadful. And by the time the tanks came rolling through, we just didn't know what to expect. And when he popped out, not only did he stand in front of the tank, he then hopped onto it to have a word with the driver. We were silent. All the television cameras was trained on him, and we were thinking, what on earth is going to happen? And he seemed to have a little chat with the guy. Then he jumped off again, and we wondered, are they going to roll over him? And at that point, some people came out from the side of the street. We couldn't see. None of us could see his face. None of us could see who these guys were, though we were all on close-up. And to this day, we do not know if he was taken away, perhaps by friends who he'd been with. He was an ordinary worker, we believe. We don't have his name. Or he was taken away by the hundreds and hundreds of plainclothes policemen around there, and he met his end in an anonymous manner, which happened also to a lot of people. It was a truly terrible, terrible day.
Thanks very much to both of you for joining us and recounting your memories of that day 20 years ago in Tiananmen Square. Kate Ady, BBC reporter who was there and joined us from London, and Jeff Widener, staff photographer for the Honolulu Advertiser and one of the photographers who took the original photos of Tank Man.
Kate Ady is one of the original BBC legends.
Both of them, absolutely legendary.
I watched Kate from Khomeini's funeral on the BBC sat feeds 20 years ago. President Obama gave a speech in Cairo today that's intended to redefine America's relations with the Muslim world.
There must be a sustained effort to listen to each other, to learn from each other, to respect one another, and to seek common ground. As the Holy Quran tells us, be conscious of God and speak always the truth.
We've been getting reaction all morning, including from you.
This is Sean from Charleston, South Carolina. Barack Obama's speeches are all about style, and they're not about substance. There was no substance in this speech.
We're continuing to take reaction. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Did he speak to you, or was it all style? Where did you find the substance in the speech? You can go to our website and find other reactions posted there. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Andrea Bernstein. Happy birthday.
This is The Takeaway. Thank you, Andrea.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.